All right, Slate, Art of War.
We're gonna talk about comics from Devil's Due. It's something you wondered if Talking Joe would ever do. I guess we'll explain it all to you. Gonna take some time to read the books we've never read. Oh, oh.
The G.I. Joe team and the Autobots reunite once more when a deadly amalgamization of Transformer technology and humanity brings both worlds to the brink of war. With two civilizations teetering on the brink and ultimate power at stake, can the forces of good overcome this horrifying new evil?
Yeah, probably can. We'll find out. Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, the G.I. Joe comics podcast. Today, we will be continuing our side quest into the miniseries and one-shots that were coming out during the America's Elite era of G.I. Joe Disavowed from Devil's Due. And today, it is the turn of G.I. Joe versus the Transformers, Volume 3, The Art of War, a five-issue miniseries from Devil's Due running March to August 2006. It was collected as a trade paperback from Devil's Due in 2006, and then later as G.I. Joe versus Transformers Volume 3 from IDW in April 2013, which also contained Black Horizon, the sequel. And joining me as usual to talk about these issues, it's a real robotic serpent overlord, it's Tim Finn.
Hello, Mark, and hello, listeners.
Hi, Tim. So we're back in the world of Devil's Due, and who brought us this comic? It was script Tim Seeley, pencils Joe Ng. Is that how would you pronounce that?
I think it's Joe Ng. I think it's sort of like ing, but you okay. But you don't spell the I. I think
right. I'll run at that again then. Joe Ng, which is a good verb for drawing a Joe comic. So he was the lead artist with Alex Milne and James Reyes also contributing. Inks were Rob Ross and M3TH, which I'm going to say is meth. Colors, Kevin Yang, Rob Ruffalo, and Tom Liu. Letters, Brian J. Crowley. Editor, Mike O'Sullivan. Art produced by Udon. The Udon chief is Eric Coe. And there is a special thanks to Mark Powers. Tim, observation, it looks like Devil's Due kind of partnered with Udon on the arts for this one.
Yeah. So at the time in 2006, so not concurrent with this third crossover, but before it, a year earlier, Dreamwave, which had the license from Hasbro to make Transformers comics, right? So nowadays we think of these licenses going to one company. But back then, Transformers was with one company, G.I. Joe was with Devil's Due. Dreamwave had fallen apart and shut down, and it was ugly. People went unpaid. Creditors went unpaid. Comics went unfinished, right? There were preview pages for the next issues that were online, and those issues were not published. So Udon was another studio like Dreamwave, which was making its own comics and also packaging comics for other studios and editors. And I don't know anything about this particular arrangement here for this third crossover miniseries at Devil's Due, but it makes sense to me in the way that Devil's Due didn't have artists who necessarily specialized in drawing Transformers. And for a couple years now, because of Dreamwave, and this even traces back to that pinup in Wizard magazine that Mark refers to sometimes in our podcasting, that article of the big 80s, Dreamwave had established sort of the new way to draw Transformers. And Udon, it's a bunch of Korean guys, but taking a lot of anime and manga influence the same way that the Dreamwave guys were. And the Dreamwave guys were Canadian. It makes sense to me that, you know, if you look at the first G.I. Joe Transformers crossover, the Transformers all look good, but they look like they're drawn by a Western artist who, you know, draws for Marvel or DC, right? And the second miniseries, they were sort of splitting the difference, as we talked about when we covered that episode, G.I. Joe versus Transformers Roman numeral 2, had an artist who was handling the robots and had an artist who was handling the people. And there seems to be sort of more of a complete packaging here where Tim Seeley writes this story and then Udon guys are doing, you know, layouts and pencils and inks and colors, and then, you know, they hand the art back. And so the robots look good in this series. And if you couldn't differentiate between any one artist who drew in that style, or if you couldn't differentiate between Dreamwave and Udon, this just looks like how the Transformers were looking in the middle 2000s, sort of like Dreamwave drew them. The humans, there's some inconsistency. And I also think this starts to, sorry, I'm spending a while on this. I think it starts to speak to, in 2006, Devil's Due has passed its peak and is heading towards sales are diminishing on some of their titles. I think G.I. Joe Reloaded has sort of come and gone or is about to by this point. And so I think this might also speak to not just a stylistic choice, you know, are there people at Devil's Due who can draw this in that, quote, Dreamwave style, but, oh, we don't have a lot of people here. We're starting to tighten our belts. Should we farm this out?
Yeah, I was just looking online as well, and apparently from March 2004, Udon Entertainment sort of launched an almost formal partnership with Devil's Due, where Devil's Due Publishing would be publishing Udon works, and the first part of that was Street Fighter trade paperback. So it looks like there's a very close working relationship slash partnership sort of leading up to this point between Udon Studios and Devil's Due.
Udon also starts publishing on its own in, I believe, 2007. And so in the same way that, you know, Devil's Due starts at Image making its own books and Image publishes them, you know, in 2004, 5, 6, Udon is packaging for other publishers. And then I believe in 2007 starts publishing on its own.
Okay. And we spoke to Tim Seeley about kind of his work on his these G.I. Joe versus Transformers projects. So let's just briefly hear what he had to say about creating them.
We had artists that we knew we could work with that were going to be really good Transformers artists, which was the hardest thing to do, is find people who could draw a Transformer. And we knew we wanted to do something big and crazy, because the one that IDW had done, or Dreamwave, sorry.
Yeah, the World War II one.
Right.
Some Dreamwave bonkers.
And so we were kind of competing with them, because they would do their own thing, and we were trying to stand out from them. And so, but we started like competing with them, trying to do something different. And so we decided, let's just go bigger and crazier. And so the idea for the third one was like, I pitched it to Josh, was what if Serpentor was made out of Megatron and other Transformers? Like, instead of being Julius Caesar or whatever, he's got Megatron. And so we used a part of the third one, because originally the cameo that we had in 2 of Cobra La was like just a joke, because Hasbro's like, you don't use them. They're are sort of ashamed of them. We don't want to use them. So it's just like a joke. But then the third one, like, I don't know, it was fun and goofy and big, and it gave them lots of new toys to play with, right? Because there was, you know, a Serpentor that transformed into a jet or whatever. So the fourth one then was, it was like, Seeley, just do whatever the hell you want.
Very good. He's, you know, he's just, I think, taking license to, expand the sand pit and just go a bit nuts with everything, is my interpretation. Sort of Nuts Part 1 is this one, and Nuts Part 2 is the sequel.
Yeah, he's also, he co-penciled the second crossover. He wrote and fourth. So more than maybe anyone else across these four miniseries, he's got his fingers in them.
Mm.
And he was art director at Devil's Due during the first one. I don't have it in front of me, so I don't remember if he gets any kind of special thanks or if we had guessed he drew one hand in a background of a panel. But
yeah, I think there's a couple of pages on here that look very Tim Seeley-esque, and I think that maybe he contributed a little bit here and there, even if uncredited.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
If we turn to the covers, it's interesting that there's two sets of connecting covers. There's a sort of set A across the five issues, and then there's a second set of connecting covers, which is credited to Udon and was available exclusively from Udon Online and conventions and so on. So we've got these two ginormous cover images of the crossover, as well as a scattering of other alternate cover images. Without going through every single cover, Tim, what's your sort of high level take on these covers?
So cover A, 1-5, is the Joe Ng five-part connecting battle on Cybertron between Autobots and Decepticons and Joes and Cobras. Notably, Bumblebee is on the left side of this five-part image, issue number one. And then by the time you get to issue number four, Hawk is front and center holding the Matrix and sort of glowing blue. And again, this is on Cybertron with a bunch of Transformers all around him. So these I find the most striking because they tell some story, they build dramatically, and the compositions are pretty good. I'm also a big fan of the colorist, Espen Grundjern, who had been coloring for Dreamwave, who's a really, really good colorist for Transformers.
The A is one sort of connecting image. It feels very much like one image. At the same time, it's got like a central figure for each one of those covers, so that each one sort of stands alone as a cover in its own right, and it's quite handsome. The other one, and I don't want to sort of steal your thunder, Tim, looks just a bit more chaotic, slightly less cohesive.
Without
the location.
I think you're talking about what's now considered the C covers, all white backgrounds, a big battle scene between Joe, Cobra, Autobot, Decepticon. So the good news here is that without a background, it doesn't get too busy. And also these are virgin covers. There's just the red, white, and blue stripe on the top. There's no G.I. Joe logo type. There's no Transformers logo type. And then in the middle, in terms of publishing, there are these B covers, which are self-contained images, which to a lesser or greater extent represent what's happening in the issue. Some of them are a little bit more story related. Some of them are just sort of, you know, a couple of characters in action pose. None of those jump out to me as really great covers, but it is interesting that across all these covers, you get quite a sampling of X Dreamwave, Udon, and Devil's Due artists. So for example, Tim Seeley draws cover 1B, Josh Midors who draws cover 4B with Predaking, and even Chris Lai draws one of them, who you have spoken to and who did a bunch of work for Sigma Six.
Indeed, in that cover with a sort of a side-on headshot of Optimus Prime with sort of Snake Eyes perched on his shoulder is a cool image, and it ends up getting used for the G.I. Joe versus Transformers omnibus cover.
Right, which collects these four miniseries.
Everything. Cool. So, plot briefing. There's a lot that goes on, so this is summarized, folks. Read the book.
Plot breakdown.
After the deactivation of Megatron and the catastrophic time-traveling events on Cybertron in the last crossover series, the Autobots have made serious progress against the Decepticons. However, on Earth, in a secret base, the US military have been experimenting combining Earth's greatest military leaders with the personality of Megatron to create a sentient, bioorganic, mechanical weapon, Serpent Ore. A cobra attack against the base on Earth alters the balance of war and unleashes Serpent Orr. He travels to Cybertron and reunites the scattered Decepticons into a force to be reckoned with once more. Autobots and Joes arrive from Earth and they do battle against Serpent Orr. Serpent Orr kills Bumblebee with his funky appendages and takes control of the Matrix of Leadership from Optimus Prime. Cobra Commander is somehow able to hack into Serpent Orr remotely and take control, but Hawk is able to touch the Matrix of Leadership, which allows Serpent Orr and the Decepticons to be defeated. The end.
What's your big top-down view of this five-issue miniseries, Mark?
I had thoughts. My big one was, this was very Transformers-y. There was a lot more, it felt a lot more Transformers focused and less G.I. Joe focused this time round. There's a lot more Transformers characters. There's a lot more of the Transformers lore. It's more of it. It feels like it's set on Cybertron itself. And there's less of the kind of the aspect of trying to join and Transformers and G.I. Joe together that was very much in the first series, where the Transformers were, for example, transforming into G.I. Joe vehicles. Very much more just straightforward take on the Transformers. Optimus Prime doesn't transform into a Histang. He just transforms into, you know, the standard truck, if he transforms at all. As a G.I. Joe person, more of the Transformers stuff, and just so much of it without that bit of having a smaller focus, like we're seeing in the kind of the Energon now world now, where you're kind of focused on just a couple of characters and you're kind of able to, you know, feel a bit more invested in it. That aspect left me a little bit colder.
I am a big Transformers fan, in addition to being a big G.I. Joe fan. Top down, I really like this series, the beginning and the middle, and I think Tim Seeley has a really good take on the factions and the balance. I think you make a good point. This is out of balance because it is so Transformers focused. I have two points on that. One, there hadn't been a lot of Transformers comics for a year, because Dreamwave fell apart and IDW was just ramping up with its first miniseries or two. By this point, Transformers Zero, IDW's first book, is cover dated October 2005. I don't think Tim Seeley said, hey, let me make this more Transformers for the Transformers fans. But that does lead into my second point, which is, after you have a miniseries, which is on Earth, which is sort of an origin for, not for Cobra, but for Cobra ramping up the first crossover. And then you have that sort of crazy, too much going on, second crossover, where not only do they go to Cybertron, but they also time travel, right? Which didn't work. Lots of fun, didn't work. I think it makes sense to have them go to Cybertron. And I think that this central idea of Serpentor being this combined idea of human technology, you know, G.I. Joe and Cobra, and Cybertronian technology is really interesting and is a really good motivator for this series. So I can see how a Joe fan who isn't as big a Transformers fan might not be as excited about this. All that said, I think the first three issues work really well, and then issues 4 and 5 run into some problems.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think that note kind of talks to a little bit about my plot briefing that feels like the build up is a lot more cohesive, and then the ending is a bit more chaotic and sort of, you know, let's say abrupt. A lot happening very quickly and sort of, you know, bring it to a conclusion kind of thing. It feels like possibly there maybe some of the events of the towards the end could have benefited from breathing a little bit.
Yeah. So we have seen in a lot of G.I. Joe and Transformers and G.I. Joe Transformers stories, an arc or a miniseries that really wants one more issue. And in my mind, miniseries want to be even numbered. You want 4 issues like Marvel miniseries in the 80s, You want 6 issues like most miniseries in the last 30 years, or you want to be 12 issues like, you know, Tom King Vision or Crisis on Infinite Earths or Secret Wars, the original Secret Wars.
Or Human Target.
Yeah.
That's good. Go and read Human Target, folks. That's really good.
There's nothing wrong with doing a 5-issue miniseries, particularly if you were going to do a 4-issue miniseries, because that is more breathing room. But 2 things. One, if in general, just sort of empirically, 5 issues isn't enough space, yes, absolutely you need 6 issues. But also specifically, G.I. Joe is so busy. You have characters and vehicles, you have Cobras and vehicles. Transformers is so busy. You have Autobots and Decepticons, and they all turn into, basically, vehicles. And then you smash them together, and... Okay, so that's one point. Very specifically, just the number of characters in here don't demand, but suggest more story space. More, as Mark said, breathing room. But also, look at what happens in the production of this. Issue 1 has 1 penciler and an inker, and the inker has some kind of a backup. I don't know if that person is doing backgrounds or does the final couple pages or what. By the end of it, you have 3 pencilers and more colorists, and you can really tell in the final issue or 2 where one scene is one colorist and another scene is another colorist. And in the final issue or 2, there are a couple panels which are really crowded, where the, quote, camera work and composition is awkward or cramped and quite unsatisfying and therefore unclear. And also, there's one panel in particular which is just not drawn well and feels like a midnight fix by whoever was in the room. Like drawing with their left hand, drawing with their non-dominant hand. But just as a quick comparison, folks, if you've got the issues or the collection in front of you, just look at pages 1, 2, and 3 of the first issue, right? There's so much care in this, right? These are sort of, I don't want to say busy pages, but these pages are quite full. There's a lot of color work going on. There are a lot of camera moves. You know, the panels are all from different angles. There are a lot of different poses, standing, leaning forward. And what is happening in this opening scene? You've got a couple of humans. That's at one scale. And you've got a Transformer head. And that's at another scale. And yet it works, because the Transformer's head is introduced slowly. He gets the entire first page of the entire miniseries. And then we can compare him in scale to the humans in this underground lab. But what happens at the end of this series? A couple of combiners, like all the Stunticons together as Menasor and all the Predacons together as Predaking, and also 2 more, fight Omega Supreme. And the fight takes place in like 3 pages. And oh man, is that not enough space for 5 Titans, that's the Transformers term. The term in the 90s was Gestalts, right? The combiners turn into their combined form. It's a Gestalt. There's just no room to have the fight be fun and clear. And I have drawn fan comics. I have drawn when I was in middle school and high school. And drawing Transformers comics is hard. As soon as they start interacting with humans, because you have these things that are 5 or 6 feet tall with these things that are 13 feet tall, Bumblebee, you know, or 15 or 20. But then you also have Autobots that are a little bigger, like Hound and Ratchet. But then you have Autobots that are even bigger, like Prime. And then you have Autobots that are bigger, like Grimlock. And then you have giant ones like Omega Supreme and the Aerial Bots together as Superion. And it's hard just to have Omega Supreme talking to Prime, because you've either got to make Prime really small or Omega Supreme really big, or you have to put Prime on a ledge or a mountaintop or Omega Supreme's shoulder. And then you have to do that sort of again. You have to scale down again when Prime is talking to a human. And then you add on top of this a bunch of Joes and Cobras and the end of this. Oh man, did this want a 6th issue?
Oh dear. And they're not making them. He's just looking at some of the pages on this 6th on the 5th issue, that you know, they're cramming an awful lot in on each page, the number of characters, the complexity. Some of these, you know, they've got a sort of big, you know, room full of an entire squad of G.I. Joe on very specific vehicles. And then they've got the, you know, squad of Autobots behind them. And then they're all going to fight it out on a single page. And, oh, dear.
Yeah, I think you're talking about page 5 of the final issue where Flint is sort of big on the bottom and the Joes are yelling,
yeah,
"Yo, Joe." And this is forced perspective. It's like you're looking through a peephole in a door without the circular, without the curvilinear warping, but you definitely have things being much bigger in the front, but you know, it doesn't really work. Like Cliffjumper in the way background, sort of under Cup's arm. Anyway, but there are also some moments of fun where, and I think this is Tim Seeley, where then the next panel, and this is the second time this happens in this story, and the first time is great in, I think, the previous issue, where you have a Joe holding a Transformers weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So Roadblock is holding some Autobot's pistol, and it's, you know, we all sort of enjoy the character of Roadblock holding his giant machine gun, which is so heavy that most people in the real world couldn't actually hold it, much less use it. But, you know, Roadblock's really big. Dwayne Johnson in that second live action movie is really big. And this goes a step further because, you know, Roadblock's now holding what is in effect this like Halloween costume exaggerated like cannon. Something that I noticed while we're still doing sort of top down is that I have a note here because let me find it in issue 4 on page 12. So we've checked in with some Joes who are prisoners, and then we cut back outside to Serpentor talking to two Decepticons who are guarding the Joes in the hallway, and it's Wild Rider. It's Breakdown. Breakdown is the white and blue Lamborghini Countach Stunticon. Excuse me, everyone. Wild Rider is the gray and red Ferrari. Breakdown says, Serpentor's just walked away. He says, "What crawled up his tailpipe? Sheesh." And then whoever the other guy is says back to him, "I don't know, but being around these humans is giving me the creeps." And it's a great exchange, but also I thought, you know, if this were a Larry Hama G.I. Joe story, they would have referred to each other by name, Mark, because...
You're right, Tim.
Thank you. And I'm not saying like Hama should have written this or like when Hama did a G.I. Joe Transformers crossover, it was better. I'm not saying that. And sometimes in Real American Hero, you know, 3 pages into every issue when Hama has all the Joes rattle off each other's names, I think, well, that's a little conspicuous, but it's also always helpful and a little fun, or fun and a little helpful. And, you know, back to that page that we were just poking at in issue 5, where, and then Roadblock is holding this giant pistol. A very specific Decepticon then attacks and gets taken out by Snake Eyes. And I didn't remember his name. I just thought, oh, it's the white and blue Tyrannosaurus Rex cassette. He was like a later cassette, right, who fits in Soundwave. Like, all right, that's a fun toy. And Tim Seeley's definitely having fun doing some specific things by having a bunch of the combiner teams sort of work together when Serpentor is turning all the Decepticons into loyalists, and having a bunch of the combined forms of the combiners fight Omega Supreme in that fight that's no fun, and having some more obscure characters show up and do something. You know, Megatron is off the board. Starscream is off the board. Soundwave is off the board. Shockwave is off the board in this story. And so considering, Mark, how Cybertron and Cybertronian centric it is, there are no Decepticons who are a main character here. It's Megatron's presence because he's in the first issue, but then it's really Serpentor. And so even though it's on Cybertron and there's not a lot of G.I. Joe, there is this G.I. Joe character who's actually the lead villain. At the beginning, it's, you know, in the first issue, you think it's Cobra Commander. And then he sort of disappears for an issue or two. So Tim Seeley is having a lot of fun by throwing in some less used characters, but it gets really crowded. And I think the least he could do is name them just for everyone's benefit.
Yes, you're right. I thought we were going to also talk about some Snake Eyes' overpoweredness potentially as well, because Snake Eyes is able to take out this Dino cassette with something.
It looks sort of like
a shard of metal.
Yeah, like a sharp broken pipe.
Ninja Bolt, it's all the time, G.I. Joe and Ninja Bolt.
And then the issue before, he's able to escape from that jail cell from those two bickering Decepticons by through the people that they've got in the wall. He does some finger knitting or Arashikage mindset and is able to overpower their minds and turn them against each other with his ninja mind against a robot brain. So don't underestimate the power of the ninja.
You know where that falls for me, that scene? That feels very much like something that would happen in the first 15 episodes of G.I. Joe, in the first three miniseries that were written by Ron Friedman before Steve Gerber or Flint Dilley or Buzz Dixon are involved in the regular season one and the regular season two episodes of G.I. Joe. You know, the same way that Cobra just casually hijacks a space shuttle launch and you have the space station with the fatal fluffies, you know, these like teddy bears that become monsters with a whistle, or, you know, Flint and Lady J fall into lava and she's got a javelin that makes a bubble, you know, like what? Mm. Like, sure. you know, visually on its surface, you think it's sort of a cool Larry Hama-ism. Like, oh, Snake Eyes is going to use his power. Well, you know, he did that once in the comic and Storm Shadow did it once on him. I think I might be getting it mixed up, but I was willing to forgive that. I think it's silly, but there's such a sort of truncation of sort of realism and logic, because, you know, the Joes also like really easily teleport to Cybertron. And there's even that line, I think it's Mainframe, who says, you know, we can only do this once. The teleporter is being held together by bubblegum and chicken wire. Like, if we get it going again, we will definitely send this backup. And I think, well, that's for the final issue. That's like a splash page for the final issue. And it was. But what sort of hurt that scene for me with Snake Eyes hypnotizing one of the Decepticons is that then the page where that Decepticon does shoot the other is so oddly composed, and there's this weird blur on his arm and his gun, his laser gun, while he's shooting him, which I think is meant to show that he's doing it really fast, but it just ends up being a very hard to decipher panel. Mm. This is issue 4, page 13, panel 5.
Scarlet does say, to be fair, wow, I had no idea your hinky ninja tricks would work on a Transformer, but I suppose our meat computers aren't that different from whatever runs these things. Nighty-night. You know, an appeal of this book is that there, if you do delve into the and linger on the dialogue, there is some quite fun touches there. You called out the holding it together with bubblegum and shit tricking wire as an example. There was a few moments where I sort of paused and thought, yeah, that is a nice little bit of dialogue.
So I'm gonna give Tim Seeley some credit for a great thing he does here, and I'm gonna give him a ding for something that I don't love. As I said in the beginning, in the overview, I think Seeley has a really good handle on the factions. Tim Seeley writes a very good Cobra Commander. His opening page, page 1, which is about Megatron doesn't speak, is good. He understands Megatron. Tim Seeley's Optimus Prime on page 1 of issue 2, right? It's all an Optimus Prime internal monologue. He's got a great take on Optimus Prime. It's not all unique. It's not new, but he understands the established Bob Budiansky, you know, Peter Cullen Optimus Prime of the 80s. And similarly, I think Seeley's got a really good take on Hawk and the idea of duty and loyalty and sacrifice. And I think he creates something really fun in Serpentor as this super intelligence which wants to conquer, has all of Megatron's smarts, but is also has the Serpentor smarts, right? The, you know, Earth history's greatest conquerors, but is a robot or is AI. And so, you know, doesn't have a soul and doesn't feel emotions. And so in terms of Serpentor's quest and then an interaction or two with Hawk late in the series, I think gives this series, plus, you know, there's a scene with Scarlet and Snake Eyes. There's, you know, some bits with Roadblock. There's some bits with Roadblock and Hawk. There's two or three great scenes between Hot Rod and Optimus Prime. I think the emotional stuff here, the character stuff, is quite good.
Can I chip in thought that sort of, I think there's, you know, quite a lot of nuance to that Serpentor character that you were talking about as well, that there's the kind of this nobility to him, this sort of honor, there's sort of conflict of, you know, these various bits of his programming that are being tugged on that, you know, he sort of wants to bring together the Decepticons, have them to rule, but then he's kind of, you know, being pulled in this other direction of seeing his, you know, his opponents, the likes of Hawk and Optimus Prime, as being worthy and not, you know, not out and out just the other, the enemy that needs to be crushed and defeated. There's more to it than that, and he's sort of getting pulled in this other direction to the extent that he almost turns to the side of the good by the end before he's hijacked by Cobra Commander, who has a good first appearance, but is sort of missing from a lot of the story, and then comes back as a almost literal deus ex machina at the end of the story.
I wondered if you wouldn't quite like that. I thought Cobra Commander showing up at the end as that surprise was good. I thought there wasn't enough room after he shows up. You know, I needed a page or two where, so he shows up in that Serpentor just starts talking as him, and you think, oh no, Cobra Commander took over Serpentor. Oh, this has gotten worse. And then I sort of needed a scene back on Earth where Cobra Commander, sitting in his chair, could issue a threat or turn to the scientist next to him or Zartan or Baroness, who we've seen nearby, and say something interesting or dire, or Cobra Commander, you know, then teleports to Cybertron and is up on a ledge over the battle as Serpentor is doing his bidding. But instead, Cobra Commander just sort of appears in that final issue as a voice, as actual dialogue from Serpentor. And Hawk says, I think it's Hawk says, or maybe it's Optimus Prime says, Cobra Commander, oh no, Cobra Commander came back after a couple issues. He's taken over Serpentor. And I thought, no, I really need to see him. You know, it feels like this was not a movie or TV show, and movies and TV shows are not filmed in the order of the script. But this feels like a TV show where the actor, like, was called away at the end of the production. And they're like, oh, well, we can't shoot Cobra Commander for the final scene, so we're just going to do his voice. But we've got the robot for Serpentor, so we're going to shoot the final scene and we're going to hear Cobra Commander, but we're not going to cut back to him.
Ironically, we cut at the very end of the book. Cobra Commander's gone into a coma. Not come out of one like G.I. Joe the movie.
We'll talk about the ending in a moment, but I want to get back to the thing that I wanted to ding Seeley for. Oh, let me do one more good thing. He does use a lot of, I don't want to say obscure Transformers, but less represented Transformers, like Overkill. And then for G.I. Joe fans, the Buzz Boar.
But Cobra's fighting back with the Boar.
It's Crystal Ball.
Rip and roar, Cobra Boar, gonna be trouble for.
G.I. Real American Hero.
Live the adventure of G.I. Joe, Road Toad, Coastal Defender, Cobra Boar, figures sold separately.
Yo, Joe!
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Buzz Boar featuring just about as prominently as it's ever featured.
Yeah.
With a reason for having it as well, you know, to bury down and get to the underground lab.
Yes. So I have two thoughts on this. One, you know, in 87, 88, 89, some of the Cobra vehicles were getting really wacky. They're really fun. They're not realistic anymore. And so he uses it. So if it's your favorite vehicle, cool. You haven't seen it in a while or ever. And he uses it to great effect, and maybe even properly, because it does dig down underground. But then I thought, wait, is that actually what it does? Or does it just like grind along the surface and go up and down mountains and valleys and hills? And so I wanted to ask you that, Mark, is Seeley sort of adding something for it to do here? Because it's not a drill tank.
Yeah. I mean, you would, in any other circumstance, I think, have a drill tank. And I think, Seeley is kind of repurposing it to do something different to the way that it's been used before, which is, to travel along the surface of of the ground, the terrain, in a particularly disruptive and not very functional way.
So when the buzz bore starts going, I needed one more panel to show it actually, like, we see it starts to dig, and then it and Cobra Commander are just underground. And I really needed one more panel where it's, now moved a few feet to the right and down, or it's like halfway, quote, submerged in a hole of its own digging. And this is a small representation of a larger problem, which I have in the visual storytelling of this miniseries, which is certain actions need not one panel, but two or three. And it's a little red flag for me that a Joe vehicle just doing sort of a normal thing in the first issue, only a couple pages in, already sort of pushes this red button for me. But it happens several times elsewhere in the miniseries when a transformer transforms into its larger form. And I'm thinking of every time the combiners combine. And there have been other Transformers comics over the 40-year history of Transformers comics where the artist isn't given enough space or doesn't take enough space. And I just want to like take everyone back to the Constructicon's first appearance in, it's like episode 10 of Transformers Season 1 Heavy Metal War. And, or if you're only familiar with the animated movie because you haven't watched the episodes, the scene at the beginning, about a third of the way into the animated movie, when the Constructicons transform into Devastator. And in both cases, the episode, the movie, sort of slow down and someone announces what is happening. You know, like, Constructicons merge for the kill. And then Cup says, it's Devastator. And then it's actually slow motion. And this Transformer sound effect slows down. And the camera, this is the movie, the camera pans up as first the feet, and then the torso, the chest, the arms, the head, right? And then Devastator lumbers forward and says something threatening. And there are a couple times in this miniseries where five combiners just become their combined form, either in one panel or in like between panels. And that's certainly the thing you're going to drop if you only have five issues, not six, and just you have to get to the fight and to the next scene. But in terms of the actual heft, the physical mass and volume of such a character and such characters, but also the emotional heft, like, there is no threat. Like, if Mark and I are standing here and like parking garage next to us, let's say we're at a G.I. Joe convention and we're like, let's go into this building and go to a panel, and we're outside. And before we can go into the convention center, the parking garage next to us turns into a 60-foot tall monster. Right? Like, if this is a movie, you're going to have reaction shots. We're going to see like aspects of the parking garage turn and twist. There's going to be a sense that it's like getting bigger or taller as it sort of folds up on itself. And you are going to worry about Mark and I, and you are going to thrill at the size and the threat of this parking garage monster. And in some of these issues of this crossover, it even happens in issue one with on pages 9 and 10 with Cobratron, and there's an attempt. It almost happens here, right? Where Zartan says, "Bats and snakes form Cobratron," and I like chuckled before I turned the page because I said, "I know what's going to happen." Tim Seeley is like making up a Cobra sort of Autobot Decepticon, a Cobra Cybertronian Megabot, and maybe it's going to be made out of sort of recognizable parts. You know, I'll see like, you know, a hand or a forearm that's this part of a vehicle, or, you know, whatever. And instead, it sort of just looks like nanites, you know, like combining. It's like a kid just like dumping sand until it's a pile of sand. They don't look like they actually connect as joints, but either way, it's fun. So there is an attempt here, and this is a pretty good, this almost pulls it off. You know, this is like a B minus. And then there's a reaction shot where Snake Eyes and Roadblock in their mech suits see it, and it's taller than them, and they're looking up, and they're a little worried. But later in the series, it happens a couple more times, and it's too compressed. All right, let me just go back to this this dialogue thing that Tim Seeley does, which I don't love. Issue 1, page 11, Scarlet and RC have this brief exchange about girl robots, and I'm ambivalent to that. You know, at this point, I don't remember exactly where Transformers lore had established gender and, you know, Transformers reproduction, like the animated movie and the episodes after the animated movie. You know, it's like the Matrix gives life. It gives sparks to Transformers. Simon Furman did something different in Generation 2, this comic that runs in 1993, where it's more like cell mitosis, which was sort of, you know, like ignored. Beast Wars in the middle 90s really adds the spark, both as a term and also as a concept. It's not just a soul, but it's like a physical sort of energy sphere. You can almost squeeze it and crush it, and they all go somewhere. And it's later, it's after these comics that we're talking about today, that in the IDW Transformers comics, gender gets expanded in Transformers. So this first reference I'm ambivalent to, that's fine. But this bit where like Bumblebee wants a kiss from RC in issue 2, page 9, and it happens again at the end of the series where there's this sort of assumption of like attraction and crushes and romance, and it's like the guy wants to get the girl, you know, like, give me a kiss. It's like, no, that doesn't work.
I had a couple of high-level thoughts, but before I get to those, I just wanted to sort of ask a question with you with your Transformers guru hat on. So in terms of the Transformers that is presented here, I had a couple of questions. The first one, and I'll present these to you together so that you can decide the order and see how to answer them. The first one is how sort of close to just general established canon is the Transformers presented here, like Optimus Prime being, I can't remember what it was, like an administrator or something like
archivist?
An archivist, thank you. Like the history of Transformers with the Autobots as a slave race, and they had a thing with like zombie Transformers at one point as well. So is that all, you know, established canon that is just, you know, familiar to Transformers readers? And the other thing was, in reading this, the word balloons usage of like transform the Autobots have a red circle around their word balloon, Serpentor has a green one, and the Decepticons have, I think, a
purple
one. Is that normal for Transformers as well?
Good questions. So to your first one, it's a mix. I don't exactly remember what Orion Pax did before he becomes Optimus Prime in season one. These are episodes written by David Wise. But the idea that Seeley is referring to, that the Matrix bestows certain wisdom and ability on the right Transformer, you know, the chosen one, that's in line with animation canon and general comics canon. Seeley does seem to be pulling more from the cartoon, but I will admit I haven't reread the Marvel US series, you know, the 80 issues by Bob Budiansky and Simon Furman in a while. As for the, what is it, Zombietron in issue three? Where they're in the sort of like wildlands, the junkyard.
Yeah. Issue three.
This is page 8.
Cannibalizers.
Yeah, we've got cannibalizers. I believe that is new. And
okay.
I wrote down in my notes, cannibalizers, adding to mythology. Now, that might be sort of close to like the Scraplets or the Junkions from the Marvel US comics in, I don't know, issue 30 or so, or the movie and season 3 in 86 after the animated movie. And maybe cannibalizers or cannibalizing as a term did exist before this. But I do think in this scene with that sort of non-character, Seeley is adding a little something, and I approve of it.
Mm. I just did a Google, and it looks like it is new to this series. So that's quite cool. It seemed like potentially one of those things that established concept, but it's looks like a cool addition to the lore.
Yeah, what that scene and that term actually reminded me of is all of the amazing mythology building that James Roberts and John Barber did at IDW around 2013, 2016 with their Transformers writing, where they would just drop concepts left and I don't mean leave behind, I mean deposit for the reader concepts left and right that expanded the Transformers and the Cybertronians. And sometimes they'd come back to them and sometimes they wouldn't. As for your second question, in the US comic, Janice Chang, a letterer who's lettered a lot of comics, invented the style for the Marvel book that the Cybertronians speak with not just square, rectangular word balloons, but also there's sort of a three-pronged, like triangular starburst shape at all four corners. And there was no differentiation in the comics between Autobot and Decepticon word balloons until Comicraft, Richard Starking's company, lettered the Generation 2 comic, which starts at the end of 92, I believe, or is it early 93? That series only ran 12 issues. Lettering was done in the computer, but printed and rubber cemented to the original art boards. So this is when computer lettering is at this hybrid state where they're not lettering on scans of the artwork that stays as digital files. And those word balloons they're rectangular or I forget hexagonal, but on the left interior side of each one, for the Autobots, there are a couple squares which get color-coded to that character. So a word balloon from Prime may have three or four little squares on the left side that are like red and blue. And the Decepticons have little triangles that are similarly color-coded. So Megatron might get green and purple because his Generation 2 tank mode. And I always thought that was cool. A Transformers fan friend of mine pointed out very smartly that one scene in that Generation 2 series reads really differently because of that lettering style. Someone says something at the bottom of a right page and you don't know who it is, but you know if it's a good guy or a bad guy before you turn the page because of that word balloon style. And this friend of mine thought that that sort of spoiled the page turn reveal. But then we also agreed that with comics, with word balloons all looking the same from character to character, with comics, you don't know who's saying it if a word balloon is aiming off panel before you turn the page. Whereas in movies or TV, if you hear a voice, you know who's saying it. We have seen this sort of combined approach to Transformers lettering in the previous two Devils Do crossover miniseries. I don't have any of the Dreamwave comics in front of me, so I don't quite remember. I think those were rectangles, but the Devils Do style, as I recall from the first crossover miniseries, is sort of normal ovals for speech balloons with red or purple around them for the robots.
Yeah, it's I guess it's relatively consistent with how it was being done in the previous series. And maybe it's sticking out much more to me this time round because the Transformers are doing a lot more of the talking in this series versus the previous.
Since I'm rarely fully satisfied with lettering, I will say that the leading, L-E-A-D-I-N-G, that's the space between lines within a word balloon, is good in this story, except for page 1 of issue 2, where Prime has all of this internal monologue, and I feel like there's too much space between each of those lines.
Right. I had another high-level thought about this series, which I guess was another detractor for me, was just around that it was quite difficult to try and hold together the multiple continuities of the universe in my head, particularly because this is now the third part of this sort of standalone universe. So we've had two stories, which we've kind of read some time apart up to this one, and by different writers as well. So it's like, what bit is specific to this continuity that I should be remembering about maybe something that's come before, or, you know, a character that maybe has died, or these different dynamics. And I think it's confused by a few moments that I can call out as examples in the story. So we had quite a big focus moment of the relationship between Snake Eyes and Scarlet. A fair amount of real estate was sort of given to that, and a big scene where Snake Eyes takes off his mask and reveals his face to Scarlet for the first time, and they kiss. But I feel like we've seen that in other continuities, so it doesn't necessarily have the dramatic moment that perhaps it was intended to. And also, you know, because of this difference in continuity, it was like, oh, I kind of would have just assumed that they were together by this point anyway.
Yeah.
Another moment, there was Storm Shadow appeared. I was like, is Storm Shadow a good guy, or is he a bad guy? Because I thought he was a bad guy.
He barely... Right. Previously.
And the last time he appeared in this series, he was a bit good, bit bad, but still on the Cobra side. But here he's part of the Joe team, being called up to help on Cybertron.
Do you remember, is he in the first crossover or the
he's
second?
He's in the second one on... he might be in the first one as he's probably yeah he is in the first one as well on Cobra. He's on the second one on Cobra's side as well, but they sort of, the Joes and Cobra are working together on Cybertron, and they have a bit of a moment where I think it's him and Cover Girl sort of exchange a glance, but then he sort of goes off back to Cobra, and we just commented on it. It seemed like a strange beat, that kind of hint of relationship or a spark. And then the sort of third character bit that sort of made me have that sort of thing, odd continuity confusion, was that here we've got Firewall as well, who I don't think has appeared in previous series, the G.I. Joe versus Transformers one, but is, you know, it's a significant creation of the Devil's Due continuity. So it's a very key character there that they've brought into this one as well, sort of blurring the lines a little bit more between the Devil's Due regular series and this one. It felt, because of that addition, it felt like almost like it's kind of, you know, squint your eyes and it could be part of just the early issues of Devil's Due when it was being written by when it was being written by Josh Blaylock.
Yes. I had that same feeling about Firewall. Like, oh, for a moment, it reminded me of this concept, which someone posted this back in like 2002 on the AllSpark, which was a Transformers discussion board, probably still is, that I spent a lot of time on around 2001, 2002, when my Transformers fandom was much bigger visibly than my Joe fandom. But someone, we were talking about the crossovers, the Marvel 1987 Joe Transformers crossover and the 1992 one. And someone described it as a converging, diverging universe where the continuities are separate when they need to be and combined when they need to be. So, you know, 84, 85, Marvel G.I. Joe and Marvel Transformers are not in the same universe. And then for that four-issue miniseries, they are. During that four-issue miniseries, one of those months in a regular Transformers series, someone says the word Cobra. I think Shockwave refers to Cobra. Like, he's referring to the events of the miniseries in the main Transformers book. But very little else comes out of it, except for Bumblebee becoming Goldbug, actually. Over in the G.I. Joe book, Hama doesn't refer to the crossover during or ever after until he's forced to. When in issue 138, Megatron lands in the middle of a Larry Hama, you know, Destro ninja story. And I have asked him, and he was not like bummed about that. It was just like part of the assignment. It's like, no, that, you know, they want me to put in these Transformers. I'll put in these Transformers. And so, you know, as a reader in my mind, between issue 138 and 142 of G.I. Joe, the Transformers, you know, and Cybertron and aliens do exist in the Larry Hama G.I. Joe continuity. But I can sort of like squint and take or leave the actual four-issue miniseries from 1987. And then once the Transformers leave after 142, no one's going to talk about it. And so sort of here, I think, just these two scenes with Firewall. And, you know, Storm Shadow doesn't do anything important in this third crossover. He's on a computer screen in one panel as a backup character. And he's in one or two panels during the big fight in the final issue or two. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't have any interesting, you know, props or movements or plot points. He's just a background character. But Firewall gets two or three interactions. You know, she has a weapon. Mainframe yells at her. She's got this funny, like, weird Easter egg of a coffee mug with Optimus Prime's face on it in the first issue, which is, like, fun, but also slightly breaks the analogy. You know, that in this world where they have Transformers, she'd have a Transformers mug. Anyway, but I did think with sort of her showing up, like, oh yeah, for a moment, this is kind of just a couple panels from the Josh Blaylock or Brandon Jurwa regular Devils Do G.I. Joe. One of my comments about this series, which is sort of a corollary to not enough space, need more pages, need another issue, is in issue one, Serpentor escapes. He's put on his costume, which we haven't talked about. And by the way, I think is very cool. I think this is a really fun adaptation of Serpentor's action figure and animation look, you know, the Ron Rudat design, into the world of Transformers, and that he has some added abilities that are more android or robotic, I think are fitting. You know, like, it would be fun if he had his air chariot and his air chariot transformed into something, but you don't need that. Okay, so near the end of issue one, he's put on his costume, he's taken up Bumblebee, and he plugs into Soundwave's head and learns all about Transformers history. And there's this big panel, which is made up of smaller panels, where we see a lot of imagery from both the cartoon, the TV show and the movie. We see Quintessons, we see a hint of Unicron, we see Alpha Trion, we see gladiators and slaves. We also, in the bottom left of it, see what I think is War Within Megatron, which is a Dreamwave invention written by Simon Furman and drawn by Don Figueroa, which is a flashback to a story that takes place before they come to Earth. And then in the bottom center, we see Optimus Primal, and he gets called out. And that's really fun because, you know, everyone loves Beast Wars. Maybe not. Lots of people love Beast Wars. but this page is sort of representative of the problem of this series, which is like, no. Primal's in the future. I know when people think of Optimus Primal and they think of, you know, dinosaurs and gorillas, and they think of sort of a prehistoric Earth. But if you watch the Beast Wars cartoon, Optimus Primal is generations later. And this is a fun Easter egg. And, you know, if you're going to put 12 references to Transformers mythology on a page, might as well put 13. But symbolically, it's like, no. He's asking including Primal is asking a question that this miniseries is not going to answer and doesn't need to ask. And then there's sort of a bookend to this, like, oh no, don't do that. Well, oh well. In the final issue, when...
Final page, you're talking about?
Yes. Let me grab it.
Where Dr. Mindbender is cosplaying as Sean Connery in that movie, Zardoz.
So I thought this series ends on this right page where Prime has been fixed by, I guess it's RC. No, it's not RC. But it's someone who looks exactly like RC, but she's green. It's Starscream, Thundercracker, and Skywarp look the same and have different colors. So sure. And Prime is thinking, and it ends with actual RC and Magnus and Hot Rod looking at a statue of Bumblebee, which I think is a really nice note, although the scale of the panel's weird. And
the girl robot is crying girl robot robo tears.
Yeah. We have pointed out in the past that sometimes Devils Do has female characters much more emotional than male characters, and male characters don't get emotional, and it seems out of balance and stereotypical or lazy. Also, I don't know how Autobots can actually physically form tears, but I'm going to let it go. So Prime gets this internal monologue on what I thought was the last page, right?
For those who were lost, we will commit their lives to our memory to remind us that our battles must be chosen wisely so that none may ever die in vain.
And we see a close-up of RC crying, looking down, and Prime continues,
ever again.
And I thought a couple things. One, Bumblebee's death in an earlier issue isn't entirely clear. And so, like, certainly Hawk and Serpentor talk about it, and it when they talk about it, it's definitive and it's really interesting and in how it motivates them. But mm-hmm. the actual scene and a half where he dies is not, it's not unclear, but it's not definitive enough. So I sort of kept expecting him to come back. Also, in the original miniseries back in 1987, he comes back as Goldbug in the main book. Anyway, I thought, okay, well, this is a sad ending. Oh, it doesn't say the end. And oh no, I turn the page and it turns out that Tim Seeley is going to take a very valuable entire page of this very rushed, compressed final issue to advertise for G.I. Joe versus Transformers Volume 4, Black Horizon, which is coming in, I don't know, 6 months, because we see Unicron and Cobra Law and Dr. Mindbender. And then there's even a quarter-size panel on this final page where Seeley, perhaps over-optimistically, or it's just an Easter egg, has Sergeant Savage and Iron Claw from G.I. Joe Extreme battling in a like wasteland of rubble and buildings, and behind them some silhouettes of what I'm going to say are Triptychon and Fortress Maximus, and I think some 1987 Headmasters and Target Masters. But the main thing here is future characters. And on the one hand, you know, if you're into these crossovers because you're like smashing your two favorite brands together, like, sure, get me excited about the next series. And Seeley does write the next series, so I think this is somewhat deserved. But I don't need this in terms of the story. Just that one reference in an earlier issue about Lobster. Issue four, there's a quick reference to Dr. Mindbender and right. Lobster's
yeah,
lobster
yeah, yeah, yeah.
costume. Right? It's like, okay, Cobra Law, sure. There was, I forget, maybe in the second crossover there was something that was teased about that.
Yeah, there was a final page kind of tease on the, okay. which isn't really paid off here apart from that reference.
And, right. That final page here. From crossover two is actually setting up crossover four. And I'm reading this final page and I'm thinking, and Prime's internal monologue continues. Inevitably, the Autobots and G.I. Joe will face new threats, threats that rise today and tomorrow. And I'm like, cool, don't do this. And then there are two panels where we check back in with Hawk, who is the emotional center of this story, who we've sort of forgotten about for a few pages and who I thought was dead. And that's where I want to sort of wrap up my criticism of this miniseries, because I really like a lot of the first three issues, and the fourth and fifth issues, there are too many artists and too many colorists and also too many characters and too many things happening and a lot of crowded, unattractive compositions in panels and pages, and a couple moments that get unclear or just sort of distracting because there's like weird forced perspective so that you can get small and medium and big characters all in the shot at the same time. Okay, so Serpentor, let me back up a moment. Serpentor gets the power of the Matrix and gets this super mode. He goes from looking like human 1986 action figure Serpentor, but slightly mech, to looking like a deluxe Insecticon, which is a reference that only Transformers fans will get. He looks like Venom, the deluxe Insecticon. He looks like Serpentor times two with more armor and spiky things and more Transformers design all over him. Okay, that actual scene is visually unclear because we see on a previous page Serpentor without his cowl, just this bald guy in the sort of armor, see the Matrix light coming out of Prime, and he has a little speech. Serpentor has a little speech, and it's good. And then he does this thing, which Tim Seeley does a few times here, where in dialogue, he makes a little reference to something from G.I. Joe or Transformers past. And here he finishes his speech about how he's ascending by saying of himself, "Arise, Serpentor Prime, arise!" And that's referring to the title of some episodes from 1986. And then you turn the page and there's just this big, I'm sorry, ugly, cool drawing, but ugly, splash page fight scene of Joes and Transformers and Triptychon fighting with some buildings behind them, and it sort of looks like Earth buildings, and then sort of more like weird, busy, compressed space fighting. And then another page, and Motormaster and I forget the leader of the Predacons. He's got a cool name. Now see Serpentor in his powered up form, and there's no background, and I sort of lose where he was, and I thought, oh wait, did this armor appear all over him as like energy wisps that come out of nowhere? Did some like robot arm tendrils come out of the Matrix and like add pieces to him, like you're stacking more Lego bricks? And I thought, okay, as a comparison, like when Megatron is transformed into Galvatron in the animated movie, you see the transformation. The camera moves, this form changes, there's a transitional form, there's a sound effect, and here it's like we blinked and we miss it.
Yeah. Presumably it's a bit like shorthand, like, in Transformers the movie when Hot Rod changes into Rodimus Prime? You know, that thing.
You got the touch! You got the
power! Arise, Rodimus Prime. Optimus.
Yeah!
No.
Yes, yes. And that scene, like, there's one piece of artwork for Hot Rod holding the Matrix and a second piece of artwork for Rodimus Prime, who's a little taller and has, like cheekbones, basically, to look a little older. And he's slightly more red and slightly less maroon. But basically, he's the same design. And there's just a crossfade.
Uh-huh.
There isn't like dozens and hundreds of new animation cells showing that transformation. And that's fine, because everything else about that scene, the sound, the lighting, the actual crossfade, Optimus Prime coming in as voiceover, the music, it all shows you and tells you what's happening. So there's a bit of shorthand there, but it works. But here, it's like I'm in the theater and I close my eyes for that moment of Hot Rod becoming Rodimus Prime. Okay, and then, as you referred to before, there's this really interesting turn where Serpentor feels remorse and is sort of neutral or maybe even a good guy. But then he gets taken over, which is cool, but as we've said, a little crunched. And then Hawk shows up and there's this very Dreamwave Udon, exciting but sort of awkwardly posed diagonal panel of Hawk jumping and lunging, I think getting a fastball special from Optimus Prime, actually.
Yeah.
And the reason why I consider this pose awkward is that it doesn't pass the silhouette test. And so the Matrix is glowing and glowing, and Hawk touches it. And I like the writing in this scene a lot. And then there are these three panels or two panels, depending on how you count, with this high key lighting, which Frank Miller did not invent this style, but let's say this is like the Sin City style of drawing and inking here, with just these hard shadows. And there's this great bit of dialogue where Hawk is getting all the wisdom of the Matrix, right? A human is getting all this Cybertronian wisdom. And he says, "My God," and then in very small lettering, "the universe is so perfect." And he says, in this tiny panel, as the light flares and is too much for them, he says, "so beautiful." And there's a little sound effect. Fizzachak. And then I guess the Matrix falls to the ground, and like Serpentor's dead and smoking on the ground, and Hawk is dead, probably, and smoking on the ground. And then Hunger, who's the leader of the Terracons, the Monstercons, the Terracons, right? Terracons form Monstructor. He's the guy with the purple head. He becomes a two-headed dragon. He wakes up, and then anyway, so I thought, okay, Hawk is dead. And what I really want over the next couple pages is not two big panels teasing the next miniseries and the fifth miniseries that never happened with G.I. Joe Extreme. Although if Tim Seeley wants to write that now, I will definitely read it. I need more about Hawk, because this sort of feels like this is not what happened. But my guess, my sort of unfair guess is like, oh, Seeley wants Hawk dead. And at the last minute, they're like, No. Put him in the last two panels. It almost seems like the same way that RC is looking at a statue of Bumblebee in the final two panels. I thought, oh, is that a statue of Hawk? Well, he's wearing the Serpentor cape. That's weird. Well, his eyes are glowing. Well, he's surveying Cybertron. Oh, I have to read this voiceover. Oh, Prime's saying that he's now like a leader on Cybertron. That's cool. That's weird. Oh, it's over. Okay, I don't feel like that final moment as big and emotional and as huge world mythology building and shattering as it is, it didn't get the like breathing room that it demanded.
Yeah, it's a little bit jarring. Those last two pages, definitely different artist. And the two pages before those with the Cobra Pterodrome in Siberia featuring Dr. Nox, that looks like Tim Seeley, those two pages to me.
Yeah, I thought I saw some Tim Seeley also where Snake Eyes plays tag with Scarlet.
Yeah, same page. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, two pages. Right, it was right. The Cobra Commander one and then
Cobra Commander the next and page. Scarlet Snake Eyes. Yeah. Oh, look, there's a nice bit in Siberia. There's a regular Viper wearing a snow serpent's coat.
Oh, yeah.
Either holding coffee or like exhaling into his gloved hands to warm them up
through a mask.
His little steam coming out when you exhale in the cold. That's neat. So I think Seeley does for most of the story a great job. I have been very hard on Tim Seeley on this show for his drawing. I think more balanced and complimentary on a lot of his writing. And as a guest, you know, other stuff he's done out of G.I. Joe and Transformer. I think Local Man is great. That's an Image series right now.
I just read it this last week. First trade paperback of that. It's a lot of fun.
Co-writing and co-drawing. You know, I haven't read his Batman and Grayson, but, you know, I think it's really cool if you make up your own stuff and draw licensed stuff like Dungeons and Dragons and G.I. Joe and then write Batman. I think that's very cool. I think he does a lot of really good work in the first 60% of this series. And then, as happens with a lot of miniseries, not just G.I. Joe or Transformers or crossovers, but particularly those, too crowded, not enough space at the end. And you can see the production schedule catching up with everyone. You know, it seems like Joe Ng has enough time to pencil issue one so that, you know, all of issue one looks great. And the last two pages don't look like they're, you know, rushed or someone necessarily helped him. But you know, by issue five, lots of people are drawing this book. There are some color shifts that I find unattractive. And, you know, like little bits, like, yeah, in issue four, there's this scene where Zartan and the Baroness are outside of a door. And Zartan seems to be listening in on whatever Cobra Commander is saying inside. And we sort of only see him very small and far away. And it's not entirely clear how he's listening. Like, does he have a stethoscope? You know, it's like, is he holding up a little microphone against the door? And again, an issue of space and size and scale.
There we go. That's where Cobra Commander had that line of dialogue.
Oh, Lobster?
Yeah, issue four. I forgot about this scene where it fell in the book. So we did see a tiny bit of Cobra Commander in issue four prior to his reappearance in five. He says, talking about the people lurking outside the door, he says, "Bah, let the fools rot. Soon I won't need them or Destro, not even Mindbender and his lobster-wearing friends. Soon I will have the power of a god." So yeah, that's the touchstone there, that there's a Cobra Lar ongoing story happening in the background with Mindbender, who we last saw on the final page of series two.
So I thought that scene was good. I really liked checking back in with Cobra Commander there, and I thought it did make sense that he mentioned Destro, but I was a little confused because Destro's not in this miniseries. And so I thought, can you save the audience a little concern by not mentioning that character who's not in this miniseries? You know, if he didn't mention him, I might say, like, why didn't he mention Destro? Let me just go back to one last comment I was making about the final big climax where after Hawk has touched the Matrix, what I was getting to is there's this very small panel where the light is overwhelming and you see Hawk and Sir Pentor. I dropped a comic. I believe it's page 18. Yeah, page 18, panel one. Hawk finishes that line that I said was really nice. He's talking about the universe, so perfect, so beautiful. And there's this tiny panel of the powered up Mecha Serpentor in silhouette and Hawk in silhouette, sort of in midair, being overwhelmed by the light of the Matrix. And I thought there are times, you know, you referred to at the end of Transformers, the movie, when Hot Rod turns into Rodimus Prime. And I thought of some similar moments, like in issue 75 of Marvel Transformers, which is its own version of Transformers the movie, because Unicron attacks. There's a scene at the end where, like, a big thing happens and there's a big explosion. And I thought of the final issue of Unicron, issue 6, which was this sort of universe-ending, continuity-ending comic from IDW a couple years back. And this, again, I'm just echoing what I've said before, but, you know, I want, like, more close-ups on Hawk, or one more panel of Serpentor reaching and saying, "No!" Or this wants to be like a splash page. This doesn't want to be, you know, like a 1/16th panel. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Given the four and almost five issues that have led up to this point, that we've got Serpentor finally defeated after, you know, becoming giant Mecha Serpentor, and also potentially the death of Hawk, relegating that to conclusion to such a tiny panel seems a bit strange. And then you've got the Matrix, you know, this thing that they've been struggling over, just clinking to the floor, without, I guess, a resolution to what happens next with that as well. And I guess you're just left to conclude when you skip forward a bit in time that Optimus Prime skips over and picks it up.
Last comparison, this scene we're talking about and the cover of this issue. You know, the cover of issue 5, cover A, Hawk in his 86 costume, even his helmet, just sort of out on the surface of Cybertron, Transformers fighting around him. But he's got the Matrix, very small, above him, and he's glowing blue. That's quite presentational. You know, that's definitely sort of arranging things so that they present stage well for a cover. It doesn't quite, you know, the battle scene is quite panoramic, but certainly gets a lot of space there. Gets a full page or cover.
Yeah, it seems a much bigger moment, doesn't it? On
yeah, and I had always assumed that cover was shorthand or only vaguely representational. Like, oh, surely Hawk's not going to get the Matrix. Oh, Hawk's getting the Matrix. Oh, Hawk's, it's so small. Let me squint and lean. Oh yeah, Hawk's getting the Matrix. Oh.
Cool. I think let's wrap up with maybe a couple of I Spies that we've not touched on so far.
I spy with my little eye.
I had one which was that we talked about the buzz bore in issue one, but alongside that is a rarely seen bat. It's the version 16 bat from 2005, which was part of the bat attack set, which came with multiple bats. And this one was an extra special bat because the figure could be disassembled into pieces and looked, you know, it somewhat different design to the regular old bat. Another I Spy was, again, I think this is probably issue one. There's a moment where Serpentor is offline and Cobra Commander is sort of like towering above him. And there's kind of all of the Serpentor kind of computerized text sort of scrolling up as if he's kind of rebooting, you know, status online, systems unknown, run check, reboot, objective, game knowledge, game power, destroy resistance, conquer, rule. Very much putting me in mind of RoboCop when he's sort of being created and he's on that table and the sort of OCP execs are kind of looming over him and sort of it's all being recorded.
Yeah, the term is POV.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing what Serpentor sees. We see what RoboCop sees.
It's Joeage time.
So Joeage, I think I've talked about mine quite a lot. I like the ambition of this, and I like a lot of the dialogue and what they're trying to do. For me, in just terms of the mix of it, it is just, it's not the kind of G.I. Joe that I'm generally drawn towards. It is very sort of sci-fi, very Transformers heavy. There's these continuity bits that just sort of take me out of the book, and rather than just enjoy it for it, you know, for what it is. It's very crowded, and I think the last couple of issues are quite flawed in terms of the number of artists working on it, and you know, definitely looking like it's not the same finish that we had in issue one. So I enjoyed revisiting this, but yeah, not my favorite of the Versus Transformers series, and not my favorite overall. But I can see the merit of the series, and if people were to score it more highly because they like different bits of, you know, the components of Transformers and G.I. Joe, fair play to them. But for me, it's probably a 6.
I would give it a 5, and I'm thinking the first 3 issues are much higher than that. And if only the next 2 issues or an additional issue could have carried that forward. I remember not liking the second miniseries, like it sort of just didn't work. And I remember thinking the first miniseries was okay, but not my thing. And to my surprise, Tim Seeley's take here is my thing. So I think of the 5 as a good 5. And if only the final 2 issues could have had more time and space.
So that's us done on G.I. Joe versus Transformers Volume 3, as it's not called.
I note that a couple times in this third crossover, there are footnotes that refer back to the second crossover. But this does feel a little bit like, since it doesn't have the Roman numeral 3, you could read this one without reading the other two.
Next time on Talking Joe Disavowed, we'll continue our look at this era from the America's Elite phase. Next up will be G.I. Joe versus Transformers 4, Black Horizon, which came out in January to February 2007, a two-parter, but I think those are oversized issues. And then, once we've done that, we'll be back onto Devil's Due America's Elite with issues 21 through to 24, which is Sins of a Mother from March to June 2007. And yeah, looking forward to seeing those from the inverted commas new team joining the book. And when we're not talking about the Devil's Due era of comics, we will, of course, be covering new comics from Skybound as they come out, as well as more besides. We've got some interesting stuff being lined up. You can find out more about us by going to talkingjoe.co.uk. That is the website. We've got a Facebook group. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. You can leave us voicemails with your thoughts on upcoming issues for us to include. We're also on Patreon, patreon.com/talkingjoe. So a big thanks to our backers: Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, Shane, Ryan, and Simon, and Chris, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. Tim, where can people find you when you are not talking to me about robotic serpent lords?
Video essays on TV and film from my creative partners in New York at our YouTube page, at Atomic Abe. My brick-and-mortar comic book shop in Somerville, Massachusetts is Hub Comics, and I write about G.I. Joe online at arealamericanbook.com.
Stuff. I sent more people your way this last week, telling them to come ask you about IDW back issues.
Cool.
Yeah. But that is us done. But until next time, remember that
nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Laters.
All right, quick question. On cover A of issue one, and don't press stop recording. Mark, on the cover to issue one with Bumblebee, his arm that's up, under his armpit, there's some red, robot stuff that's part of the explosion. Is that his side door? Is that miscolored? Or is that someone behind him?
It looks like he's been blown up, doesn't it? I mean, there's nothing obvious that would belong to another.
The explosion is both behind him, but also his arm. This is where I feel this way about some of the Udon guys and some of the Dreamwave guys, where they sometimes compress space, characters are too close to each other, or they're too far from each other for what's actually happening. Someone's running, but someone's right in front of them, or someone's blasting, and their pose is if the target is 30 feet away, but then someone is actually 5 feet in front of them. And that's not related to humans being one scale and Transformers being another. I saw this in Transformers comics at Dreamwave. I feel like some of these artists are very good at drawing any one Transformer, any mech robot, but in terms of actually populating a panel, sometimes the space gets pinched. Anyway.
Yeah, staring at this, it looks like, I think it's his door, which would be on, I guess, the equivalent of his ribs sort of flying off.
Yeah.
But the angle of it looks a bit odd, and the colouring of it being sort of that reddy pink just doesn't make it look like it quite fits. But yeah.
But I do like this cover, these covers, and I do like the colouring on these covers.